Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader, brought to you by Wellington Square Bookshop. Our guest today is Liba Taub, author of Ancient Greek and Roman Science, one of the very short introductions in the wonderful Oxford University Press series. And I have to brag that I have every single one of them in my bookstore, and I have to be careful because I have to update it routinely. I'm running out of room. This one will be released on August 25th. Liba is the curator of the Whipple Museum in Cambridge, and her other work includes Ptolemy's Universe, Ancient Meteorology, and Etna and the Moon, all of which I am excited to read. So scientific knowledge is based on empirical evidence garnered from observation and experiment. It relies on data and facts, not speculation and belief, which seems to be the lodestone on which our current civilization relies in part, which is a shame. So the Greeks and the Romans laid the foundation for objectivity and an absence of personal bias in understanding nature and our world. They looked for natural explanations for natural phenomena, not on supernatural or untestable claims, theories and models to explain and predict. And it's funny because, you know, as I was preparing for today using my devices, my iPhone, my laptop, I realized that the nomenclature of these technological marvels spring from the ancients, at least explorers. Telephone is a Greek portmanteau of tele, far, and sound. Likewise, television. Camera is from Latin, the camera obscura. Computer is from computare. Then the telescope is Greek, satellite is Latin, and so on, not to mention philosophy, psychology, and actually our solar system itself. So how is it that almost 3,000 years later, we still rely on these roots to understand our natural and technological world? It's amazing to me. And to Lisa, whose work takes us back to a time when professionals and amateurs, if you will, spend a good portion of their days studying and, in effect, loving the idea of procuring information and knowledge and using it to predict the circumference of the world pretty accurately, or the displacement of water, Eureka, or the piston pump, or the astrolabe. So let's chat with Lisa about her explanation of science in the ancient world of the Greeks and the Romans. Hi, Liba. Did I say Lisa? Hi, Liba. How are you?
Yeah. Okay, thanks very much. I should also probably say that I'm no longer curator of the Whipple Museum of the History of Science. I'm now, well, my successor, Dr. Joshua Nall, is director, and I'm director of research.
That's the problem with going to Wikipedia.
It's okay. I just thought I'd mention it. Oops.
So, well, before we jump in, I guess, as we were talking about before we began, with regard to the Oxford series of very short introductions, which is for the neophyte, which is me to a certain extent. What we talked about a little bit before is, you know, what is science? And as you discuss in your book at the beginning, which really intrigued me, how is it interrelated with philosophy? And you even mention ethics.
So it's an interesting question, what is science? And I think that if we had a group of scientists today in the room, they wouldn't necessarily agree about what it is. As you said, I do discuss it in the book, and science is not an ancient word. So that's also part of the problem. We're using a modern term, a modern concept to describe something that looks similar or familiar to us in antiquity. And we'll probably talk a little bit about religion later on too. And I'll flag that as well as another. Ancient Greek and Roman religions were so different for the most part from our conception of religion. And when we talk about God or gods, there'll be also differences as well. So what is science in antiquity? I'm trained as an historian of science, and I've decided some time ago that I would take a shorthand definition that it's the attempt to explain natural phenomena, the things that we see around us, the natural world. I will say that as I've gotten older and maybe more questioning, I've wondered, well, what is nature as well? And this is something that the ancient Greeks and Romans didn't always agree about. And even some of them, like Aristotle, who wrote quite a bit about nature, the Greek word being phusis, gives us different definitions that were current in his time. So for my purposes, when I'm talking about ancient Greek and Roman science, I'm talking about the Greeks and Romans' efforts to explain the world around them and how it works. So the idea that it can be understood is fundamental, that it can be explained.
Well, when we talk about these people, and many of us are familiar, okay, with Plato, Aristotle, Socrates, maybe even Ptolemy or Pythagoras or the Epicureans, but who are, I guess definitionally, who are these people on whose shoulders Newton and Einstein stood?
That's an interesting question. So I'm going to, there's two bits to it, I think. In terms of who people like Newton and other famous scientists that we think about, the work that they used, for instance, Ptolemy, the ancient Greek mathematician who lived in the second century, who worked on astronomy, but also geography and also music theory and other things as well. They're authors, and I think that's very important. For the most part, but not always, and Pythagoras is a great exception here, they're people who wrote down and shared their ideas to an important extent that their ideas were then copied by others and read by others and shared by others and survived over centuries and thousands of years. So there are those people who wrote down their ideas and shared them. And you've mentioned some of the great names. But then someone like Pythagoras, we don't think he wrote anything, and we don't think he did because some of our ancient sources suggest that he didn't, but other people wrote down his ideas and we have reports.
So when you talk about the ancients and you talk about, okay, Pythagoras didn't write anything down, what's always been fascinating to me is, what is the source material that you rely on and how does it still exist? And are we always like, we don't have any work of Socrates, but we have someone who wrote it down because he was listening to them. But do we actually have the real stuff, or are we always relying on secondary sources?
That's a great question. And I'll just emphasize also then when I'm talking about the Greco-Roman period, I'm talking about a very long period of time from the 8th century before our era to, let's say, the 6th century in our era. So that's a very long period of time. In some cases, what we have in terms of a written text may be very close to what was written by the original author. In some cases, there'll be forgeries or fakes, which is also kind of interesting with a famous name attached to it. In some cases, we only have reports of what people said or what they taught or what they wrote, or we have what are called fragments, which are snippets and or quotations. And sometimes the source of the quotations are hostile sources and may be giving us twisted or warped reports. I also want to emphasize that we have other sources that are not textual sources, that are not words. We have visual material as well. And this is one of the things that I tried to emphasize in my very short introduction. I tried to choose images to show some of the rich variety of the sources we can use. So for instance, coins sometimes very deliberately depict things that people thought were important. For instance, astrological signs. You know, and the importance of astrology, for instance, for Roman politics.
And the interesting thing, since you mentioned it, is you do have lots of visual material in the book, plus the endnotes, the references, suggested reading. Again, for a neophyte, it gives a really good jumping off point, just mentioning that. And then I tend to jump around, but it was funny when you said satirize, because you read a book like this and you don't expect to laugh, but whenever you read about Aristophanes and Socrates up in the clouds, you know, you almost have to laugh out loud and you think about it. That's amazing. It's almost amazing as the science, the fact that someone could satirize and create humor out of all this. And even today, we understand the very nature of the humor.
Which I think is one of the things that's so great about reading these ancient texts is that sometimes it will seem very foreign, very different, very difficult, but other times you can imagine that if the author walked into the room, you'd be able to sit down and have a really good, really interesting conversation, and you'd be able to understand each other. I'm glad you brought up, you know, what's in the back of the book in terms of suggested reading. And I know, of course, that you own a bookstore, and I very much like to visit your bookstore. But one of my goals in what I did in the book and also with this podcast is I very much hope that we will encourage people to go and read some of the ancient sources, because some of them really are a great treat and a great thrill to read. And I'll just mention Diogenes Laertius, for instance, a third century of probably, we don't know his dates for sure, author or compiler of our, from our period, third century. And he is one of our main key sources for many of the people who we think we know something about, but for whom no text survives. And sometimes he'll give different accounts. So for instance, he's one of the key authorities on what we know about Pythagoras, for instance. But it's also really fun reading Diogenes Laertius. So for instance, when he tells us about Epicurus, he tells us that the reason he turned to philosophy, the reason the subject attracted him, is because he was really fed up when his teachers couldn't explain what chaos meant, the meaning of chaos in the poet Hesiod. So it just, there's a very human quality in some cases to his account. And I recommend him, The Lives of the Eminent Philosophers.
Yeah, I just interviewed someone who wrote Diogenes, who's French, Diogenes the Cynic. He seems like he was a real pain in the ass, wasn't he?
Comment.
Well, you're not insulting him. He's not around to hear it. But he just was mean-spirited and said horrible things to people and did horrible things in public, which I won't mention. But yeah, and that's another thing is that, okay, how do we actually know? And that's, I told you I jump around. But, you know, Epicurus, Epicurean, Cynic, these are words that today have different connotations than they did, or Stoic.
Yes, exactly. And it's really important that you're bringing that up because, you know, as you say, we hear these words today and we have certain associations which may be pretty far removed from what they meant in their own time period. The other thing that is a bit of a hobby horse for me, so I'll bring it in, is when we talk about Aristotle in particular and we use the word Aristotelian, a lot of things are laid at his doorstep that I'm not sure he would agree with. And that's a complicated story, and it's actually one that I'm hoping to investigate more, perhaps in another book someday. But it's, you know, your caution here that sometimes the phrases that are used, it reminds me, an old friend many years ago talked about, you know, words like communist and love, that we don't all agree on what those things mean. And I think that labeling these people, I mean, Epicurus wasn't an Epicurean, he was Epicurus in his period. The people who were Epicureans were the people who attended, who went and hung out with him basically at the garden. That was the name of his school. And they were his followers, and they identified as his followers. But what the membership of a philosophical school meant varied also depending on which school it was, and whether or not you would adhere to the views of the founder of the school, or whether or not it was more of a loose sort of affiliation.
The other interesting thing about that is, you bring in there's so many people that we obviously can't talk about all of them, but say Herodotus and his excursions, philosophical excursions and scientific excursions on the Nile. There's a good story you can just pull out, and it just shows you how many different modalities and studies people were intrigued with. So talk about the Nile. And then we're back in Egypt, which are the precursors of the Greeks and whose shoulders they stood on.
And it's interesting because, you know, when we think of Herodotus, you know, so-called father of history, we don't necessarily think of him as being an historian of science. And I have actually argued elsewhere that maybe we should think of him as an historian of science, because he does give us quite a detailed report about trying to find out from people in Egypt, how come the Nile floods? And how can you explain this? And he wasn't happy with the explanations he got. And then he talks about those clever Greeks and gives different Greek explanations from different sources. And one comes from Homer, the epic poet. And then, ta-da, Herodotus kind of explains why his view is the right one. So he turns out to be a clever Greek too. And I think there's lots going on there. But one of the points that I'd like to emphasize is we don't think of Herodotus as a scientist. We don't think of him as a natural philosopher or lover of wisdom about nature. We think of him as an historian. Well, the word historia refers actually to description, and he is a very good describer in some ways. And of course, he's very curious. And he's writing for what we think was a broad audience, and I think trying to talk about things that he thought other people were interested in. And to me, that signals that probably quite a few people were interested in questions like, how come that river acts the way it does? And you talked before about people like Newton standing on the shoulders of giants. And yes, there are certain very famous names like Aristotle, Plato, Ptolemy, Galen, Archimedes. But then there are lots of other people where we only have a name, or we may not even have a name. And they were part of what I would call scientific enterprise is too grand a word, I think, for this period. But they were also individuals who had an interest in understanding how does the world work and how does it work, and sometimes in very detailed sorts of ways.
If we go further afield, one of the stories that has always intrigued me, because I think it's mythological, and you can correct me, but you look at Daedalus and Icarus, And here are these wings made of wax and feathers. And in your mind, you go, well, and Leonardo in his mind. And then, but what it really is, it's a tale of pride going before a fall. And Daedalus warns his son, and his son doesn't heed the warning, but Daedalus makes it, he flies on. And so what do you think of that? How do you incorporate that with regard to the ancients? Is it science?
I wouldn't say it's science, but I mean, certainly what strikes me is also the use of imagination. And I mean, whether or not someone tried to do that, who knows? It's certainly imaginable. It's plausible, possibly. And I mean, as you say, you kind of link it to Leonardo, and it comes back to something we were saying earlier, that in some cases we can see similarities between ideas and maybe even ambitions between antiquity and later periods, early modern period, our contemporary period. But of course, there are also differences as well. And I think that tightrope that we will have to walk between being sensitive to what the differences are, but also recognizing that we can, to some extent, understand these ancient voices, these ancient pictures, etc. That's what makes doing, the study of the ancient world or another culture possible.
Yeah, and further on in the book, you talk about not only Einstein, but Heisenberg and Schrodinger. Mm-hmm. It's almost as if it wasn't for the Dark Ages, we would be off to the stars by now. And that's one of the things that's always bothered me. I always feel like there was this arc that became kind of a catenary, in that if the arc had just continued and the Greeks had been left alone and the wars didn't occur, where would we be today? You ever wonder that?
I don't, actually. But it's just, my way of doing history is different. It's just, I try to avoid what are called counterfactuals. And, it's a different act of imagination. And I respect it and admire it when people do it. It's just not what I've taken to do. I think, though, that you're pointing to a question that a lot of people ask, what if and why not? Why didn't they do this? And why didn't they innovate more in terms of technology? And I think one of the fairly standard answers is that, well, the ancient Greeks didn't really value practical innovations to the same extent that, let's say, the Romans did, that they were more interested in abstract things. And one of the things that I tried to do in my book was to show that even people like the pre-Socratic philosophers, who we put that label on them, we say that they're philosophers, when we look in Diogenes Laertius or we look in Aristotle or Plato, later authors giving accounts of their lives, sometimes they'll also give a report of them doing something very, very practical. So we have Thales of Miletus and we have Democritus, who's associated with atomism, both being credited with having cornered the market on olive presses and made a killing in the market. And we're told that Democritus said that he did this just to show that philosophers could do that if they wished to. And I think that more work needs to be done to really understand how practical achievements and technologies were valued by some of these individuals or not, and to make a blanket statement about a culture over roughly 1,000 years, I think is very difficult to do. I would say similarly to say that the Romans were only interested in technology and practical things and not in abstract matters is also not quite right.
When you talk about olives, I wonder, and you kind of mentioned it in our correspondence before, what you wanted to talk about is, what do these guys do for their day jobs?
Well, that's a great question. And it's really important to bring this up, that most of the people that I talk about in the book and most of the people that we would associate with ancient Greek and Roman science weren't getting paid to do what they were doing for the most part. Now, we haven't said anything about physicians, and physicians were probably getting paid in some way. And in the later period, some of the people who were philosophers were getting paid even by their city, for instance, as educators. Now, in Plato's time, some people, and he tells us about this, were getting paid to teach, of course. So it's not that people weren't getting paid to do things, but most of the people that we recognize as important philosophers didn't have a day job in the sense of how they earned their living. They earned their living through wealth that had been accumulated and that they benefited from. And they were landowners, et cetera. But that they weren't paid doesn't mean that they didn't devote themselves to it and take it very seriously. And what the rewards were for doing it were not monetary. Sometimes it was also fame and being associated with either a certain branch of knowledge or a certain achievement. And Vitruvius, the Roman author on architecture, complains actually that athletes got more money and more fame in a certain way than great thinkers did. And he, complains at some length that, these great thinkers, people who come up with new ideas and new inventions should be having similar rewards as well.
It reminds me of when I think of the Romans, and I mentioned why I like the Greeks better. It seems the Romans would be like almost like the movie Oppenheimer. These scientists are doing something because they love the idea. Can this be done? And then the Department of Defense uses it for a horrible purpose. And that's why Oppenheimer, I have become death. Destroyer of worlds. So I was thinking about the physical plant, and we mentioned that in our correspondence as well. So if you take something like the odometer, the Romans used that in order to do their milestones, their mile markers, and that helped them in saying, hey, you need to go 60 milestones in order to find these troops, or the things like the dioptera or the astrolabe, the armillary spheres, which I guess the Whipple collection has a lot of this stuff hanging out.
Well, not ancient ones, though, sadly. We have it was found in Egypt, but it's probably a Roman sundial on display. It actually isn't ours. It belongs to another university museum, the Fitzwilliam. Many, many ancient Greek and Roman sundials survive, actually. I think there are over 800 in existence, and there's a wonderful website devoted to these sundials run. People look up Topoi, T-O-P-O-I, and the database, they'll find it. But we have accounts, even in Plato, of, for instance, physical models of planets, of the sun, the moon. And even though Plato is often, we're told that he didn't think that sensory experience was important, he does say in the Timaeus, which is his great work that explains a view of cosmology, whether or not it's Plato's own or not, we don't know. In that work, and I'm hesitating, I'm not using the word dialogue because the beginning is dialogic, but it turns into a monologue. There is a reference to a model, and we have accounts of different sorts of planetary models having been made, for instance, by Archimedes, by Posidonius, but the models don't survive. And when we talk about other things not surviving, Archimedes, many of his works do survive. Posidonius, who was considered in antiquity as one of the greatest natural philosophers, we only really have reports of his writings. A new book has just been published by John Hall on Posidonius's meteorology. And I'm hoping that people will read that because it gives us a new view of this important thinker and someone who was also credited not just with thinking, but with having made a physical model of what, I hesitate to use the word heavens because I want people to understand this is astronomical.
Well, the other thing is when we're talking about astronomical and you mentioned the atomists, and I know this is not, you've already said this is not what you do, but if you think about the fact that there were people who ascribed to the view, although they questioned it, that it was a heliocentric universe and that there is this indivisible particle, which is close to true still.
Yeah.
And again, you go, what if they had just kept going with that? But I know that's not what you do, but what if
I could ask the question. I'm not even sure what keep going means, if you see what I mean. I think this is one of the things that's so interesting. In the last chapter of the book, as you say, I mentioned Heisenberg, I mentioned Schrodinger, I mentioned Einstein. And it is very powerful that there are many scientists, mathematicians who today even feel a real affinity with ancient Greek thinkers. And that recognize that some of the questions that they were trying to answer are the same questions that we and current scientists and mathematicians are still asking. And we come up with different answers and we refine those answers and we maybe tweak the questions a little bit. And some of the answers look similar, like the word atom. And I mentioned the word apeiron in that chapter too. And Max Born, for instance, suggesting that the word unbounded might be useful. So I think there's also a desire to, on the one hand, to innovate in science, but then we, again and again, and you brought up Newton standing on the shoulders of giants and that claim that he made, also to show connections to the past. And it's an interesting tension there that, and we see it in antiquity too, that even people who are claiming to innovate oftentimes, like Aristotle, will make it clear that he's building on the work of others and building on it in different ways. It doesn't mean not criticizing, but it means kind of reviewing what they've done, saying, can we take it further? And the idea of taking things further is present very much in antiquity. The idea that we may not have perfect knowledge, but we can have better understanding is very much there.
That's as close as you come to what would happen since you're linking the ancients. And there is a gap between someone thinking it's heliocentric and then the church executing people because they did that. If they hadn't executed them and said, wait a minute, this is a good idea, I won't do it. This is the third time I've gone off on that. I won't do it.
You're saying heliocentric, and that's, I think, not what you mean. Geocentric. Oh, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I just wanted to.
Thanks. Yeah.
It's okay.
Now, I was thinking of the sun being in the center, but yeah, I don't know. Yeah, right.
Well, I mean, it's interesting because for the Pythagoreans, we're told that they had an idea that there was a hearth in the center. It might not have been the sun or a fire. It might have been a fire. It's not quite clear what it was, but we know, we have excellent evidence from antiquity that not everyone agreed that the earth was central to the cosmos. Cosmos is their word. It's related to our word cosmetic. So the idea that there's also something beautiful about the world is built into that conception. But some people, including Claudius Ptolemy, knew from the mathematics that you could, I mean, that mathematically you could describe the world, the universe, and the astronomical body's motions either having a geocentric or a heliocentric model, that the maths would still be the same, but the physics is different.
What about stories that all of us learn sometimes as children? Well, because you mentioned Archimedes, and you know, was he commissioned to determine whether something was gold? Did he get into his bathtub and go, holy Moses, except Eureka, get out of his bathtub and run naked through the streets of Athens? I mean, why do we even have that story? And is it true, or may it be true?
Well, I'm willing to believe something like it is true. I don't actually, you know, I don't know. One of the things that is interesting, I think, about Archimedes, in some ways, we don't know that much about him as a person. And yet there's different, some of his writings begin with a dedication to someone or sort of an introductory note to someone. I've sent you some other things to read, and here's another work you might like, or here's, it's not clear that it's, he's associated with the so-called cattle problem. It's not clear whether or not he wrote it, but it's addressed to Eratosthenes. And he says, and he's writing, here's a problem you and your colleagues might like to work on. So we do have this sense of Archimedes as being a person and someone who is engaged with other people in the world, not that he's just keeping himself to himself. And that in itself is kind of interesting. Whether he jumped up and ran out into the street, don't know. Whether or not he was commissioned to test the metal contents, I think it's plausible.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because we know he was involved in other practical things. And this comes back to my earlier point, is that we're sometimes, there's a line, well, oh, the Greeks weren't interested in anything practical. I think maybe that's an exaggeration. And I've mentioned Vitruvius before. I mean, you were talking about how do we know? Well, Vitruvius, in his work on architecture, gives us a sort of potted history of mathematics, which is really worth having a look at. It's so different from the normal account. Now, I'm not saying that he got it right or his interpretation, you know, some of it seems a little far-fetched. But for instance, he credits Plato with teaching us how to determine the measurements of a field, an agricultural field. He credits Pythagoras with teaching us how to make a staircase without having to have a carpenter. And what's intriguing is that he's crediting these two people with very practical mathematics. And our normal picture of Plato, it would be that he would say, no, that's not what I do.
But with Archimedes, like just the screw itself, the idea of it's as important as the wheel. And yeah. He's almost like, I always think of him like, you know, Edison, Elon Musk, or Steve Jobs, as Jobs said, you know, making a dent in the universe. And these people, that's what they did. They made a dent in the universe of their time. And it's still amazing to me. Absolutely amazing.
And I think one of the things, I think one of the things that's particularly interesting about Archimedes is we know he, like Posidonius, who I mentioned also, that they were greatly revered in antiquity. And Cicero recounts, you know, that we hear stories about going to look for his grave, for instance, and it was all overgrown and him finding it. And we have some accounts of various, almost like tourist activities to go visit different sites that were associated with scientific achievement, which is kind of interesting. It gives us a signal, I think a very strong signal, that what we regard as scientific activities, mathematical achievements, were actually valued by people in antiquity even though Vitruvius complains they weren't valued enough.
It's like mentioning Cicero. We could spend the next 5 hours talking about Cicero. And, you know, it's not science as such, but some of the writings he had, you could lift out of there and put in today's world, and it would be just as true as it was then.
Absolutely. What specifically are you thinking about?
His thoughts on death.
Yeah.
And how to die in the proper way. It's no different than C.S. Lewis or someone.
I think also another thing that's very interesting about Cicero is, I mean, of course, he's a Latin author, he's Roman, but he's very much interested in learning what ancient Greek philosophers had to say, and in also reporting it and sharing it in his writings too. So we see, I mean, for some Roman authors, they want to celebrate their Romanness and not have much to do with Greeks, but others, and Cicero is one of them, are happy to take what they think is interesting and useful.
Yeah, and give credit as well.
Yeah, absolutely giving credit.
Tough for Romans to do. So I never understand, is it Pliny or Pliny the Elder? And
I think it's Pliny the Elder, but interesting because when I said Pythagoras earlier, because I'm born in the United States, but I live in England now and hear people say Pythagoras, not Pythagoras.
Yeah.
So, but it's Pliny the Elder.
Right, Diogenes. But so Pliny, I'm going to be going to Pompeii next week.
Great. Have you been before?
Yeah, this time I'm taking my entire family because I said, I need to show all of you this. But then, you know, you think about the story of him escaping, the fact that he was actually there, and then is the younger writing about that experience. But he's a scientist too, correct?
Well, that's a great question again, and I'm really glad you've raised this. I mean, he, for many years, was very much disparaged as, you know, a compiler, that he's got all kinds of old wife tales, et cetera. But I think, you know, he's very interesting because he's an educated man, clearly, and he has very, very wide-ranging interests. And in some cases, he's reporting things that he's read in books. And he also tells us in gory detail in the first book of the Natural History, it's a very detailed table of contents. He tells us how many authorities he's read in different languages, you know, in Greek and Latin, how many facts he's collated. And he's not claiming to come up with any new theories, but he's reporting different ideas. And sometimes he'll say, I don't understand this. I mean, this is what I've read, but I don't quite get it. He'll do that sometimes about astronomy. And I think you mentioned that I wrote a book on ancient meteorology. Yeah. And he was a very interesting and important source for me because his book on agriculture is in the center of his natural history. And there he has a great deal to say about meteorology, weather prediction, explaining weather. And he's a source both of Roman knowledge and practice, which tends to be very empirical, as he describes it, but also some of the Greek astronomical work as well that relates to meteorology. So he's a great source. I don't think he's innovating. I will also say that he's a little bit like Vitruvius in that he complains, and he's interesting. He complains that in our time of peace in which he lives, he's saying, no, none of my colleagues, none of my Roman countrymen are doing enough in terms of primary scientific work in the way that the ancient Greeks did long ago. So it's very interesting, and it's quite a moving passage, I think, as well. And it comes also, I think, to some of the questions about what sort of society and culture fosters scientific work. I also love Pliny because he's an example of someone who wasn't a professional, he wasn't a specialist, he was someone who was really, really interested. And I think today we would call him a popularizer. I mean, he was writing for other people, and he also was read, you know, for a very, very long period of time and taken very, very seriously, an important source of what the state of knowledge was in his time.
You think about the fact that he read widely. And now I'm doing this for the fourth time, and you may get exasperated with me. What if the library at Alexandria still existed and didn't burn?
Don't know. Don't know. But it doesn't. And nevertheless, we still have we have so many ancient sources, some of which have never been, for modern readers, properly gone through, properly edited, properly studied. So as in with many things, I'm sure literature, history, and the history of science as well, there's certain paths that people go down. I mean, when I was a graduate student, we used to joke about the Darwin industry and, that no one should work on anything having to do with Darwin because you just get buried in the secondary literature. There'd be too much to read. You couldn't do a PhD. Okay, clearly people still do work on Darwin, but there are lots of ancient authors out there who haven't been studied as much as they could be and as much as they should be. And there's certainly ancient texts that have not been, studied or read much at all. And in fact, when I wrote my book on ancient meteorology, which was published in 2003, the work previous to that had been published in 1907 in Germany. Wow. So I have a colleague who's hoping to do what I think is a very important project on Roman mathematics. And there's a lot more evidence of what was done by Roman people doing different sorts of mathematics than we have easy access to. And I encourage people to, if you have Latin and Greek, there are a lot of texts out there that haven't been read. There's a lot of Aristotle even that hasn't been read. I mean, the meteorology is not a work by Aristotle that many people who do ancient philosophy have read. I've mentioned Plato's Timaeus. Not that many people have read, I don't think, that work, and it's terrific. You should definitely read it, Sam, if you haven't. And I think every listener to this podcast should get a copy and read it. It's very powerful. And it was also historically the bit of Plato that was available for part of the Middle Ages when nothing else was, not the whole work, but part of it. So that did represent Plato in a period when people didn't have his other works. So that there's a cosmology that emphasizes order and beauty and the importance of us understanding how the world is structured. That's a part of Plato that sometimes we don't know about because we focus on other works.
These potential readers will have to be as enthusiastic as you and I are. I don't know. The other thing that I was thinking about when you talked about the Darwinian industry is you go back to Epicurus and this concept of looking for pleasure and avoiding pain being the highest purpose in life. You can go straight forward to the utilitarians and David Hume and Jeremy Bentham and John Stuart Mill, who are basically just rehashing exactly those principles and just creating an industry because each of them had a slightly different angle on it, basically trying to make it seem like, okay, it's really nice to pursue pleasure, but you also ought to help people too, because they wanted to make sure that it was a good thing, not just selfish.
Well, and I think also, coming back to, the question that you raised at the very beginning with me and people, why do people do science? When they look around the world, they don't understand it. The Epicureans and the Stoics, and we have actually three letters of Epicurus that survived, that it's because of Diogenes Laertius, who I mentioned earlier, that he had access, he copied something out. And it's very clear that Epicurus thinks that we shouldn't worry about things too much, that we should hold on to the principle that we can understand things, but we don't have to understand them in every single detail, but to just know that in principle, the world can be understood, and that will free us from worry. And that's different than pleasure. Mm-hmm. So a freedom from anxiety, a freedom from worry, and that is a way to live. And it's a practical teaching. It's an ethical teaching in that sense, that it's practical, is very central to Epicureanism and to Stoicism as well. But what's interesting, I think, also about Epicurus is that this idea that you can know too much, not know too much, but you can try too hard to get down to the detail, and that in some things, for instance, understanding how weather works, that we can't go high enough up to a cloud and look at the cloud, and we just have to accept certain explanations, for instance, that might be by analogy. That's a very, very powerful tool in ancient philosophy about nature, drawing explanations from analogies. And he says that should be enough.
Well, now today, it's in order to avoid anxiety and worry, we just have a pharmaceutical industry that takes care of that for us. But as
I don't think he'd advocate that.
No, I don't. Well, who knows? Who knows? Potion. Well, as we wind down, I'd like to touch on what we discussed briefly before and maybe at the beginning. These, at the end of the book, which is really cool, because I said it leads the reader on further, is when you ask these seminal questions. I have them right here, you know, and I'll go through them because this is your last paragraph. How did the world begin? What is the world made of? Are there other worlds? How do humans relate to other parts of the universe? How do we know what the best one is? How do we know? It's, I think, where you and I come together on this is, how do we know what we think we know? And that's the thing I said, I wake up every morning wondering, is this a solipsistic world and only one of us is here?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, and I think that you know, comes back to, you know, what we've been talking about for the last, whatever, 50 minutes or so. And I'll come back to Epicurus here, that Epicurus, and not only for him, I mean, for Plato, for Aristotle, we think we know what we know, and they would each give different answers. And I mean, Epicurus is someone who thought that sensory knowledge was useful, but he also thought that reasoning and understanding, so for instance, reasoning from analogy was useful too. Aristotle, very similarly. The role of the senses and how important they are for gaining knowledge in Plato, I think that there's evidence, for instance, in the Timaeus, the part that I mentioned, the physical model. It's an interesting idea that maybe sense information was more important for him than we might sometimes think. But these are questions that were live questions for the people who were trying to explain the world. And they came at it in different ways and also would sometimes redo their own explanations, which I think is very interesting. One point that hasn't really come up, and I'd like to just bring it up now, is that some of these people weren't working alone at all. We've mentioned Plato, we've mentioned Aristotle and Epicurus. They worked with other people as well. I mentioned Archimedes writing to people. Aristotle, as you know, was head of a school. The school is called the Lyceum, sometimes called the Peripatos. It's very clear that there were questions that people kept wanting to return to. And we have some documents that are literally collections of questions or collections of problems where, and sometimes they're very detailed, like why do older men like to drink, for instance? And, oh, you know, why are dreams more vivid in the autumn, for instance? And did Plato really say that God was always doing geometry? I mean, Plutarch gives us that question, but we have collections of questions that people were asking. And I think that's something really important to emphasize, that the idea of curiosity, imagination, questioning, striving to understand and to also discuss things is really key to what's going on in this broader Greco-Roman culture. And the some Romans participated in it as well, as you mentioned Cicero. It's not just coming up with the answer. Sometimes it's coming up, and Epicurus was one, with multiple possible answers. We could explain it this way or that way or this other way. One of those is probably right, but in principle, know that we can understand.
That's a great way to conclude, because all the questions that were asked then are still questions we ask now. And it's not that you're putting a gloss on it. You're actually giving us the actual source material that, okay, we might have been thinking these same questions now, but we wouldn't have the insight that we do in order to help us work it out even further. So on August 25th, Oxford sends me these really nice racks, but I keep asking for more racks. And I said, I can't arrange them by number because no one knows what that means, which is confusing. So I arranged them all alphabetically. So yours will go in the appropriate spot on August 25th. And I look forward to explaining to people why it's incredibly important to read it. And then after you read it, like you said, is to go back to the source material, and the reference material you include in the end really does help a lot in that. So Liba, thanks so much for joining us
today.
Thank you.
Thanks very much, Sam.
Bye-bye.